Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. Phantoms by Stephen Milhauser. The Phenomenon. The phantoms of our town do not, as some think, appear only in the dark. Often we come upon them in full sunlight when shadows lie sharp on the lawns and streets. The encounters take place for very short periods, ranging from 2 or 3 seconds to perhaps half a minute, though longer episodes are sometimes reported. So many of us have seen them that it's uncommon to meet someone who has not. Of this minority, only a small number deny that phantoms exist. Sometimes an encounter occurs more than once in the course of a single day. Sometimes 6 months pass, or a year. The phantoms, which some call presences, are not easy to distinguish from ordinary citizens. They are not translucent, or smoke-like, or hazy. They do not ripple like heat waves, nor are they in any way unusual in figure or dress. Indeed, they are so much like us that it sometimes happens we mistake them for someone we know. Such errors are rare and never last for more than a moment. They themselves appear to be uneasy during an encounter and swiftly withdraw. They always look at us before turning away. They never speak. They are wary, elusive, secretive, haughty, unfriendly, remote. Explanation number one. One explanation has it that our phantoms are the auras or visible traces of earlier inhabitants of our town, which was settled in 1636. Our atmosphere, saturated with the energy of all those who have preceded us, preserves them and permits them, under certain conditions, to become visible to us. This explanation, often fitted out with a pseudo-scientific vocabulary, strikes most of us as unconvincing. The phantoms always appear in contemporary dress. They never behave in waves that suggest earlier eras, and there's no evidence whatever to support the claim that the dead leave visible traces in the air. History. As children, we are told about the phantoms by our fathers and mothers. They, in turn, have been told by their own fathers and mothers, who can remember being told by their parents, our great-grandparents, when they were children. Thus, the phantoms of our town are not new. They don't represent a sudden eruption into our lives, a recent change in our sense of things. We have no formal records that confirm the presence of phantoms throughout the diverse periods of our history, no scientific reports or transcripts of legal proceedings, but some of us are familiar with the second-floor archive room of our library, where in 19th-century diaries we find occasional references to the others, or them, without further details. Church records of the 17th century include several mentions of the devil's children, which some view as evidence for the lineage of our phantoms. Others argue that the phrase is so general that it cannot be cited as proof of anything. The official town history, published in 1936 on the 300th anniversary of our incorporation, revised in 1986 and updated in 2006, makes no mention of the phantoms. An editorial note states that the authors have confined themselves to ascertainable fact. How we know? We know by a ripple along the skin of our forearms, accompanied by a tension of the inner body. We know because they look at us and withdraw immediately. We know because when we try to follow them, we find that they have vanished. We know because we know. Case study number one. Richard Moore rises from beside the bed where he has just finished the 42nd installment of a never-ending story that he tells each night to his 4-year-old daughter, bends over her for a good-night kiss, and walks quietly from the room. He loves having a daughter. He loves having a wife, a family, though he married late at 39. He knows he wasn't ready when he was younger, not in his doped-up 20s, not in his stupid, wasted 30s, when he was still acting like some angry teenager who hated the grown-ups. And now he's grateful for it all, like someone who can hardly believe that he's allowed to live in his own house. He walks along the hall to the den, where his wife is sitting at one end of the couch, reading a book in the light of the table lamp, while the TV is on mute during an ad for vinyl siding. He loves that she won't watch the ads, that she refuses to waste those minutes,
She reads books, that she's sitting there waiting for him, that the light from the TV is flickering on her hand and upper arm. Something has begun to bother him, though he isn't sure what it is, but as he steps into the den, he's got it. He's got it. The table in the side yard, the two folding chairs, the sunglasses on the tabletop. He was sitting out there with her after dinner, and he left his sunglasses. Back in a sec, he says, and turns away, enters the kitchen, opens the door to the small screen porch at the back of the house, and walks from the porch down the steps to the backyard, a narrow strip between the house and the cedar fence. It's 9:30 on a summer night. The sky is dark blue. The fence is lit by the light from the kitchen window, the grass black here and green over there. He turns the corner of the house and comes to the private place. It's the part of the yard bounded by the fence, the side yard hedge, and the row of three Scotch pines, where he set up two folding chairs and a white ironwork table with a glass top. On the table lie the sunglasses. The sight pleases him, the two chairs turned a little toward each other, the forgotten sunglasses, the enclosed place set off from the rest of the world. He steps over to the table and picks up the glasses. A good pair of expensive lenses, nothing flashy, stylish in a quiet way. As he lifts them from the table, he senses something in the skin of his arms and sees a figure standing beside the third Scotch pine. It's darker here than at the back of the house, and he can't see her all that well. A tall, erect woman, 40-ish, long face, dark dress. Her expression, which he can barely make out, seems stern. She looks at him for a moment and turns away, not hastily, as if she were frightened, but decisively, like someone who wants to be alone. Behind the Scotch pine, she's no longer visible. He hesitates, steps over to the tree, sees nothing. His first impulse is to scream at her, tell her that he'll kill her if she comes near his daughter. Immediately, he forces himself to calm down. Everything will be all right. There's no danger. He's seen them before. Even so, he returns quickly to the house, locks the porch door behind him, locks the kitchen door behind him, fastens the chain, and strides to the den, where on the TV a man in a dinner jacket is staring across the room at a woman with pulled-back hair who's seated at the piano. His wife is watching. As he steps towards her, he notices a pair of sunglasses in his hand. The look. Most of us are familiar with the look they cast in our direction before they withdraw. The look has been variously described as proud, hostile, suspicious, mocking, disdainful, uncertain. Never is it seen as welcoming. Some witnesses say that the phantom shows slight movements in our direction before the decisive turning away. Others, disputing such claims, argue that we cannot bear to imagine their rejection of us and misread their movements in a way flattering to our self-esteem. Highly questionable. Now and then we hear reports of a more questionable kind. The phantoms, we are told, have grayish wings folded along their backs. The phantoms have swirling smoke for eyes. At the ends of their feet, claws curl against the grass. Such descriptions, though rare, are persistent, perhaps inevitable, and impossible to refute. They strike most of us as childish and irresponsible, the results of careless observation, hasty inference, and heightened imagination corrupted by conventional images drawn from movies and television. Whenever we hear such descriptions, we're quick to question them and to make the case for the accumulated evidence of trustworthy witnesses. A paradoxical effect of our vigilance is that the phantoms, rescued from the fantastic, for a moment seem to us normal, commonplace, as familiar as squirrels or dandelions. Case study number 2. Years ago, as a child of 8 or 9, Karen Karsten experienced a single encounter. Her memory of the moment is both vivid and vague. She can't recall how many of them there were or exactly what they looked like, but she recalls the precise moment in which she came upon them. One summer afternoon, as she stepped around to the back of the garage in search of a soccer ball and saw them sitting quietly in the grass. She still remembers her feeling of wonder as they turned to look at her before they rose and went away. Now, at age 56, Karen Karsten lives alone with her cat in a house filled with framed photographs of her parents, her nieces, and her late husband, who died in a car accident 17 years ago. Karen is a high school librarian with many set routines. the TV programs, the weekend house cleaning, the twice yearly visits in August and December to her sister's family in Youngstown, Ohio, the choir on Sunday, dinner every 2 weeks at the same restaurant with a friend who never calls to ask how she is. One Saturday afternoon, she finishes organizing the linen closet on the second floor and starts up the attic stairs. She plans to sort through boxes of old clothes, some of which she'll give to Goodwill and some of which she'll save for her nieces, who will think of the collared blouses and floral print dresses as hopelessly old-fashioned, but who might come around to appreciating them some day, maybe. As she reaches the top of the stairs, she stops so suddenly and completely that she has a sense of her own body as an object standing in her path. 10 feet away, 2 children are seated on the old couch near the dollhouse. A third child is sitting in the armchair with the loose leg. In the brownish light of the attic, with its one small window, she can see them clearly. 2 barefoot girls of about 10, in jeans and t-shirts, and a boy, slightly older, maybe 12, blonde-haired, in a dress shirt and khakis, who sits low in the chair with his neck bent up against the back. The 3 turn to look at her and at once rise and walk into the darker part of the attic where they're no longer visible. Karen stands motionless at the top of the stairs, her hand clutching the rail. Her lips are dry and she's filled with an excitement so intense that she thinks she might burst into tears. She does not follow the children into the shadows, partly because she doesn't want to upset them, and partly because she knows they are no longer there. She turns back down the stairs. In the living room, she sits in the armchair until nightfall. Joy fills her heart. She can feel it shining from her face. That night, she returns to the attic, straightens the pillows on the couch, smooths out the doilies on the chair arms, brings over a small wicker table, sets out 3 saucers and 3 teacups. She moves away some bulging boxes that sit behind the couch, carries off an old typewriter, sweeps the floor. Downstairs in the living room, she turns on the TV, but she keeps the volume low. She's listening for sounds in the attic, even though she knows that her visitors don't make sounds. She imagines them up there, sitting silently together, enjoying the table, the teacups, the orderly surroundings. Now each day she climbs the stairs to the attic where she sees the empty couch, the empty chair, the wicker table with the 3 teacups. Despite the pang of disappointment, she is happy. She is happy because she knows they come to visit her every day. She knows they like to be up there, sitting in the old furniture around the wicker table. She knows. She knows. Explanation number 2. One explanation is that the phantoms are not there, that those of us who see them are experiencing delusions or hallucinations brought about by beliefs instilled in us as young children. A small movement, an unexpected sound, is immediately converted into a visual presence that exists only in the mind of the perceiver. The flaws in this explanation are threefold. First, it assumes that the population of an entire town will interpret ambiguous signs in precisely the same way. Second, it ignores the fact that most of us, as we grow to adulthood, discard the stories and false beliefs of childhood but continue to see the phantoms. Third, it fails to account for innumerable instances in which multiple witnesses have seen the same phantom. Even if we were to agree that these objections are not decisive and that our phantoms are in fact not there, the explanation would tell us only that we are mad without revealing the meaning of our madness. Our children. What should we say to our children if, like most parents in our town, we decide to tell them at an early age about the phantoms? We worry that we have filled their nights with terror, or perhaps have created in them a hope, a longing for an encounter that might never take place. Those of us who conceal the existence of phantoms are no less worried, for we fear either that our children will be informed, unreliably, by other children, or that they will be dangerously unprepared for an encounter should one occur. Even those of us who have prepared our children are worried about the first encounter, which sometimes disturbs a child in ways that some of us remember only too well. Although we assure our children that there's nothing to fear from the phantoms, who wish only to be left alone, we ourselves are fearful. We wonder whether the phantoms are as harmless as we say they are. We wonder whether they behave differently in the presence of an unaccompanied child. We wondered whether, under certain circumstances, they might become bolder than we know. Some say that a phantom, encountering an adult and a child, will look only at the child, will let its gaze linger in a way that never happens with an adult. When we put our children to sleep, leaning close to them and answering their questions about phantoms in gentle, soothing tones, until their eyes close in peace, we understand that we have been preparing in ourselves an anxiety that will grow stronger and more aggressive as the night advances. Crossing over. The question of crossing over refuses to disappear, despite a history of testimony that many of us feel ought to put it to rest. By crossing over is meant, in general, any form of intermingling between us and them. Specifically, it refers to supposed instances in which one of them, or one of us, leaves the native community and joins the other. Now, not only is there no evidence of any such regrouping, of any such transference of loyalty, but the overwhelming testimony of witnesses shows that no phantom has ever remained for more than a few moments in the presence of an outsider, or given any sign whatever of greeting or encouragement. Claims to the contrary have always been suspect, the insistence of an alcoholic husband that he saw his wife in bed with one of them, the assertion of a teenager suspended from high school that a group of phantoms had threatened to harm him if he failed to obey their commands. Apart from statements that purport to be factual, fantasies of crossing over persist in the form of phantom tales that flourish among our children and are half-believed by naive adults. It is not difficult to make the case that stories of this kind reveal a secret desire for contact, though no reliable record of contact exists. Those of us who try to maintain a strict objectivity in such matters are forced to admit that a crossing of the line is not impossible, however unlikely, so that even as we challenge dubious claims and smile at fairy tales, we find ourselves imagining the sudden encounter at night, the heads turning toward us, the moment of hesitation, the arms rising gravely in welcome. Case study number 3. James Levin, 26 years old, has reached an impasse in his life. After college, he took a year off, holding odd jobs and traveling all over the country before returning home to apply to grad school. He completed his coursework in 2 years, during which he taught one introductory section of American history, and then surprised everyone by taking a leave of absence in order to read for his dissertation, The Influence of Popular Culture on High Culture in Post-Civil War America, 1865 to 1900, and think more carefully about the direction of his life. He lives with his parents in his old room, dense with memories of grade school and high school. He worries that he's losing interest in his dissertation. He feels he should rethink his life, maybe go the med school route, and do something useful in the world instead of wasting his time wallowing in abstract speculations of no value to anyone. He speaks less and less to his girlfriend, a law student at the University of Michigan, nearly 1,000 miles away. Where, he wonders, has he taken a wrong turn? What should he do with his life? What is the meaning of it all? These, he believes, are questions eminently suitable for an intelligent adolescent of 16, questions that he himself discussed passionately 10 years ago with friends who are now married and paying mortgages. Because he's stalled in his life, because he is eaten up with guilt, and because he is unhappy, he has taken to getting up late and going for long walks all over town, first in the afternoon and again at night. One of his daytime walks leads to the picnic grounds of his childhood. Pine trees and scattered tables stand by the stream where he used to sail a little wooden tugboat. He's always bumping into his past like that. And across the stream is where he sees her, one afternoon in late September. She's standing alone between two oak trees looking down at the water. The sun shines on the lower part of her body, but her face and neck are in shadow. She becomes aware of him almost immediately, raises her eyes, and withdraws into the shade where he can no longer see her. He has shattered her solitude. Each instant of the encounter enters him so sharply that his memory of her breaks into 3 parts, like a medieval triptych in a museum: the moment of awareness, the look, the turning away. In the first panel of the triptych, her shoulders are tense, her whole body unnaturally still, like someone who has heard a sound in the dark. Second panel, her eyes are raised and staring directly at him. It can't have lasted for more than a second. What stays with him is something severe in that look, as if he's disturbed her in a way that requires forgiveness. Third panel, the body is half turned away, not timidly, but with a kind of dignity of withdrawal, which seems to rebuke him for an intrusion. James feels a sharp desire to cross the stream and find her, but 2 thoughts hold him back. his fear that the crossing will be unwelcome to her, and his knowledge that she has disappeared. He returns home but continues to see her standing by the stream. He has the sense that she's becoming more vivid in her absence, as if she's gaining life within him. The unnatural stillness, the dark look, the turning away, he feels he owes her an immense apology. He understands that the desire to apologize is only a mask for his desire to see her again. After 2 days of futile brooding, he returns to the stream, to the exact place where he stood when he saw her the first time. 4 hours later, he returns home, discouraged, restless, and irritable. He understands that something has happened to him, something that is probably harmful. He doesn't care. He returns to the stream day after day, without hope, without pleasure. What's he doing there in that desolate place? He's 26, but already he's an old man. The leaves have begun to turn. The air is growing cold. One day, on his way back from the stream, James takes a different way home. He passes his old high school with its double row of tall windows and comes to the hill where he used to go sledding. He needs to get away from this town, where his childhood and adolescence spring up to meet him at every turn. He ought to go somewhere, do something. His long, purposeless walk seemed to him the outward expression of an inner confusion. He climbs a hill, passing through the bare oaks and beeches and the dark firs, and at the top looks down at the stand of pine at the back of Cullen's auto body. He walks down the slope, feeling the steering bar in his hands, the red runners biting into the snow, and when he comes to the pines he sees her sitting on the trunk of a fallen tree. She turns her head to look at him, rises, and walks out of sight. This time he doesn't hesitate. He runs into the thicket, beyond which he could see the whitewashed back of the body shop, a brilliant blue front fender lying up against a tire, and farther away a pickup truck driving along the street. Pale sunlight slants through the pine branches. He searches for her but finds only a tangle of ferns, a beer can, the top of a pint of ice cream. At home he throws himself down on his boyhood bed, where he used to spend long afternoons reading stories about boys who grew up to become famous scientists and explorers. He summons her stare. The sternness devastates him but draws him to, since he feels it is a strength he himself lacks. He understands that he's in a bad way, that he's got to stop thinking about her, that he'll never stop thinking about her, that nothing can ever come of it, that his life would be harmed, that harm is attractive to him, that he'll never return to school, that he will disappoint his parents and lose his girlfriend, that none of this matters to him, that what matters is the hope of seeing once more the phantom lady who will look harshly at him and turn away, that he is weak, foolish, frivolous, that such words have no meaning for him, that he has entered a world of dark love from which there is no way out. Missing children. Once in a long while a child goes missing. It happens in other towns. It happens in yours. The missing child who is discovered 6 hours later lost in the woods. The missing child who never returns, who disappears forever, perhaps in the company of a stranger in a baseball cap who was last seen parked in a van across from the elementary school. In our town there's always those who blame the phantoms. They steal our children, it is said, in order to bring them into the fold. They're waiting for the right moment, when we have been careless, when our attention has relaxed. Those of us who defend the phantoms point out patiently that they always withdraw from us, that there's no evidence they can make physical contact with the things of our world, that no human child has ever been seen in their company. Such arguments never persuade an accuser. Even when the missing child is discovered in the woods, where he has wandered after a squirrel, even when the missing child is found buried in the yard of a troubled loner in a town 200 miles away, the suspicion remains that the phantoms have had something to do with it. We who defend our phantom against false accusations and wild inventions are forced to admit that we do not know what they may be thinking, alone among themselves, or in the moment when they turn to look at us before moving away. Disruption. Sometimes a disruption comes, the phantom in the supermarket, the phantom in the bedroom. Then our sense of the behavior of phantoms suffers a shock. We cannot understand why creatures who withdraw from us should appear in places where encounters are unavoidable. Have we misunderstood something about our phantoms? It's true enough that when we encounter them in the aisle of a supermarket or clothing store, when we find them sitting on the edge of our beds or lying against a bed pillow, they behave as they always do. They look at us and quickly withdraw. Even so, we feel that they have come too close, that they want something from us that we cannot understand, and only when we encounter them in a less frequented place, at the back of the shut-down railroad station or on the far side of a field, do we relax a little. Explanation number 3. One explanation asserts that we and the phantoms were once a single race, which at some point in the remote history of our town divided into two societies. According to a psychological offshoot of this explanation, the phantoms are the unwanted or unacknowledged portions of ourselves, which we try to evade but continually encounter. They make us uneasy because we know them. They are ourselves. Fear. Many of us at one time or another have felt the fear. For say you are coming home with your wife from an evening with friends. The porch light is on, the living room windows are dimly glowing before the closed blinds. As you walk across the front lawn from the driveway to the porch steps, you become aware of something over there by the wild cherry tree. Then you half see one of them for an instant, withdrawing behind the dark branches which catch only a little of the light of the porch. That is when the fear comes. You can feel it deep within you, like an infection that's about to spread. You can feel it in your wife's hand tightening on your arm. It's at that moment you turn to her and say, with a shrug of one shoulder and a little laugh that fools no one, "Oh, it's just one of them." Photographic evidence. Evidence from digital cameras, camcorders, iPhones, and old-fashioned film cameras divides into two categories, the fraudulent and the dubious. Fraudulent evidence always reveals signs of tampering. Methods of digital imaging manipulation permit a wide range of effects, from computer-generated figures to digital clones. Sometimes a slight blur is sought to suggest the uncanny. Often the artist goes too far and creates a hackneyed monster phantom inspired by third-rate movies. More clever manipulators stay closer to the ordinary, but tend to give themselves away by an exaggeration of some feature, usually the ears or nose. In such matters, the temptation of the grotesque appears to be irresistible. Celluloid fraud assumes well-known forms that reach back to the era of fairy photographs, double exposures, chemical tampering with negatives, the insertion of gauze between the printing paper and the enlarger lens. The category of the dubious is harder to disprove. Here we find vague, shadowy shapes, wavering lines resembling ripples of heated air above a radiator, half-hidden forms concealed by branches or by windows filled with reflections. Most of these images can be explained as natural effects of light that have deceived the credulous person recording them. For those who crave visual proof of phantoms, evidence that a photograph is fraudulent or dubious is never entirely convincing. Case study number 4. One afternoon in late spring, Evelyn Wells, 9 years old, is playing alone in her backyard. It's a sunny day, school's out, dinner's a long way off, and the warm afternoon has the feel of summer. Her best friend is sick with a sore throat and fever, but that's all right. Evie likes to play alone in her yard, especially on a sunny day like this one, with time stretching out on all sides of her. What she's been practicing lately is roof ball, a game she learned from a boy down the block. Her yard is bounded by the neighbor's garage and by thick spruces running along the back and side. The lowest spruce branches bend down to the grass and form a kind of wall. The idea is to throw the tennis ball, which is the color of lime Kool-Aid, onto the slanted garage roof and catch it when it comes down. If Evie throws too hard, the ball will go over the roof and land in the yard next door, possibly in the vegetable garden surrounded by chicken wire. If she doesn't throw hard enough, it will come right back to her with no speed. The thing to do is make the ball go almost to the top so that it comes down faster and faster. Then she's got to catch it before it hits the ground, although a one bouncer isn't terrible. Evie is pretty good at roof ball. She can make the ball go way up the slope, and she can figure out where she needs to stand as it comes rushing or bouncing down. Her record is 8 catches in a row, but now she's caught 9 and is hoping for 10. The ball stops near the peak of the roof and begins coming down at a wide angle. She moves more and more to the right as it bounces lightly along and leaps into the air. This time she's made a mistake. The ball goes over her head. It rolls across the lawn toward the back and disappears under the low-hanging spruce branches not far from the garage. Evie sometimes likes to play under there, where it's cool and dim. She pushes aside a branch and looks for the ball, which she sees beside a root. At the same time, she sees two figures, a man and a woman, standing under the tree. They stare down at her, then turn their faces away and step out of sight. Evie feels a ripple in her arms. Their eyes were like the shadows on a lawn. She backs out into the sun. The yard does not comfort her. The blades of grass seem to be holding their breath. The white wooden shingles on the side of the garage are staring at her. Evie walks across a strange lawn and up the back steps into the kitchen. Inside, it's very still. A faucet handle blazes with light. She hears her mother in the living room. Evie does not want to speak to her mother. She does not want to speak to anyone. Upstairs in her room, she draws the blinds and gets into bed. The windows are above the backyard and look down on the rows of spruce trees. At dinner, she's silent. "Cat, got your tongue?" her father says. His teeth are laughing. Her mother gives her a wrinkled look. At night, she lies with her eyes open. She sees the man and woman standing under the tree, staring down at her. They turn their faces away. The next day, Saturday, Evie refuses to go outside. Her mother brings orange juice, feels her forehead, takes her temperature. Outside, her father is mowing the lawn. That night, she doesn't sleep. They are standing under the tree, looking at her with their shadow eyes. She can't see their faces. She doesn't remember their clothes. On Sunday, she stays in her room. Sounds startle her. A clank in the yard, a shout. At night, she watches with closed eyes, the ball rolling under the branches, the two figures standing there looking down at her. On Monday, her mother takes her to the doctor. He presses a silver circle against her chest. The next day, she returns to school, but after the last bell, she comes straight home and goes to her room. Through the slats of the blind, she can see the garage, the roof, the dark green spruce branches bending to the grass. One afternoon, Evie is sitting at the piano in the living room. She's practicing her scales. The bell rings and her mother goes to the door. When Evie turns to look, she sees a woman and a man. She leaves the piano and goes upstairs to her room. She sits on the throw rug next to her bed and stares at the door. After a while, she hears her mother's footsteps on the stairs. Evie stands up and goes into the closet. She crawls next to a box filled with old dolls and bears and elephants. She can hear her mother's footsteps in the room. Her mother is knocking on the closet door. "Please come out of there, Evie. I know you're in there." She does not come out. Captors. Despite widespread disapproval, now and then an attempt is made to capture a phantom. The desire arises most often among groups of idle teenagers, especially during the warm nights of summer, but is also known among adults, usually but not invariably male, who feel menaced by the phantoms or who cannot tolerate the unknown. Traps are set, pits dug, cages built, all to no avail. The non-physical nature of phantoms does not seem to discourage such efforts, which sometimes display great ingenuity. Walter Hendricks, a mechanical engineer, lived for many years in a neighborhood of split-level ranch houses with backyard swing sets and barbecues. One day he began to transform his yard into a dense thicket of pine trees in order to invite the visits of phantoms. Each tree was equipped with a mechanism that was able to release from the branches a series of closely woven steel mesh nets, which dropped swiftly when anything passed below. In another part of town, Charles Reese rented an excavator and dug a basement-sized cavity in his yard. He covered the pit, which became known as the dungeon, with a sliding steel ceiling concealed by a layer of sod. One night, when a phantom appeared on his lawn, Reese pressed a switch that caused the false lawn to slide away. When he climbed down into the dungeon with a high-beam flashlight, he discovered a frightened chipmunk. Others have used chemical sprays that cause temporary paralysis, empty sheds with sliding doors that automatically shut when a motion sensor is triggered, even a machine that produces flashes of lightning. People who dream of becoming captors fail to understand that the phantoms cannot be caught. To capture them would be to banish them from their own nature, to turn them into us. Explanation number 4. One explanation is that the phantoms have always been here long before the arrival of the Indians. We ourselves are the intruders. We seized their land, drove them into hiding, and have been careful ever since to maintain our advantage and force them into postures of submission. This explanation accounts for the hostility that many of us detect in the phantoms, as well as the fear they sometimes inspire in us. In weakness, which some dismiss as negligible, is the absence of any evidence in support of it. The Phantom Lorraine. As children, we all hear the tale of the Phantom Lorraine, told to us by an aunt or a babysitter or someone on the playground, or perhaps by a careless parent desperate for a bedtime story. Lorraine is a phantom child. One day she comes to a tall hedge at the back of a yard where a boy and girl are playing. The children are running through a sprinkler or throwing a ball or practicing with a hula hoop. Nearby, their mother is kneeling on a cushion before a row of hollyhock bushes, digging up weeds. The Phantom Lorraine is moved by this picture in a way she doesn't understand. Day after day, she returns to the hedge to watch the children playing. One day, when the children are alone, she steps shyly out of her hiding place. The children invite her to join them. Even though she is different, even though she can't pick things up or hold them, the children invent running games that all three can play. Now every day the Phantom Lorraine joins them in the backyard, where she is happy. One afternoon the children invite her into their house. She looks with wonder at the sunny kitchen, at the carpeted stairway leading to the second floor, at the children's room with the two windows looking out over the backyard. The mother and father are kind to the Phantom Lorraine. One day they invite her to a sleepover. The little phantom girl spends more and more time with the human family who love her as their own. At last the parents adopt her. They all live happily ever after. Analysis. As adults, we look more skeptically at this tale, which once gave us so much pleasure. We understand that its purpose is to overcome a child's fear of the phantoms by showing that what the phantoms really desire is to become one of us. This, of course, is wildly inaccurate, since the actual phantoms betray no signs of curiosity and rigorously withdraw from contact of any kind. But the tale seems to many of us to hold a deeper meaning. The story, we believe, reveals our own desire to know the phantoms, to strip them of mystery. Fearful of their difference, unable to bear their otherness, we imagine, in the person of the Phantom Lorraine, their secret sameness. Some go further. The tale of the Phantom Lorraine, they say, is a thinly disguised story about our hatred of the phantoms, our wish to bring about their destruction. By joining a family, the Phantom Lorraine in effect ceases to be a phantom. She casts off her nature and is reborn as a human child. In this way, the story expresses our longing to annihilate the phantoms, to devour them, to turn them into us. Beneath its sentimental exterior, the tale of the Phantom Lorraine is a dream tale of invasion and murder. Other towns. When we visit other towns which have no phantoms, often we feel that a burden has lifted. Some of us make plans to move to such a town, a place that reminds us of tall picture books from childhood. There you can walk at peace along the streets and in the public parks without having to wonder whether a ripple will course through the skin of your forearms. We think of our children playing happily in green backyards where sunflowers and honeysuckle bloom against white fences. But soon a restlessness comes. A town without phantoms seems to us a town without history, a town without shadows. The yards are empty, the streets stretch bleakly away. Back in our town, we wait impatiently for the ripple in our arms. We fear that our phantoms may no longer be there. When sometimes, after many weeks, we encounter one of them at last, in a corner of the yard or at the side of the car wash, where a look is flung at us before the phantom turns away, we think, now things are as they should be. Now we can rest a while. It's a feeling almost like gratitude. Explanation number 5. Some argue that all towns have phantoms, but that only we are able to see them. This way of thinking is especially attractive to those who cannot understand why our town should have phantoms and other towns none, why our town, in short, should be an exception. An objection to this explanation is that it accomplishes nothing but a shift of attention from the town itself to the people of our town. It's our ability to perceive phantoms that is now the riddle, instead of the phantoms themselves. A second objection, which some find decisive, is that the explanation relies entirely on an assumed world of invisible beings whose existence can be neither proved nor disproved. Case study number 5. Every afternoon after lunch, before I return to work in the upstairs study, I like to take a stroll along the familiar sidewalks of my neighborhood. Thoughts rise up in me, take odd turns, vanish like bits of smoke. At the same time, I'm wide open to striking impressions. That ladder leaning against the side of a house with its shadow hard and clean against the white shingles, which project a little, so that the shingle bottoms break the straight shadow lines into slight zigzags. That brilliant red umbrella lying at an angle in the recycling container on a front porch next to the door. That jogger with a shaved head, black nylon shorts, and an orange sweatshirt that reads, in 3 lines of black capital letters, "Eat well, keep fit, die anyway." A single blade of grass sticks up from a crack in a driveway. I come to a sprawling old house at the corner, not far from the sidewalk. Its dark red paint could use a little touching up. Under the high front porch on both sides of the steps are those crisscross lattice panels painted white. Through the diamond-shaped openings come pricker branches and the tips of ferns. From the sidewalk I can see the handle of an old hand mower, back there among the dark weeds. I can see something else, a slight movement. I step up to the porch, bend down to peer through the lattice. I see 3 of them seated on the ground. They turn their heads toward me and look away, begin to rise. In an instant, they're gone. My arms are rippling as I return to the sidewalk and continue on my way. They interest me, these creatures who are always vanishing. This time I'm able to glimpse a man of about 50 and 2 younger women. One woman wore her hair up, the other had a sprig of small blue wildflowers in her hair. The man had a long straight nose and a long mouth. They rose slowly but without hesitation and stepped back into the dark. Even as a child, I accepted phantoms as part of things like spiders and rainbows. I saw them in the vacant lot on the other side of the backyard hedge or behind garages and tool sheds. Once I saw one in the kitchen. I observe them carefully whenever I can. I try to see their faces. I want nothing from them. It's a sunny day in early September. As I continue my walk, I look about me with interest. At the side of a driveway next to a stucco house, the yellow nozzle of a hose rests on top of a dark green garbage can. Farther back, I can see part of a swing set. A cushion is sitting on the grass beside a 3-pronged weeder with a red handle. The disbelievers. The disbelievers insist that every encounter is false. When I bend over and peer through the openings in the lattice, I see a slight movement caused by a chipmunk or mouse in the dark weeds, and instantly my imagination is set in motion. I seem to see a man and 2 women, a long nose, the rising, the disappearance. The few details are suspiciously precise. How is it that the faces are difficult to remember while the sprig of wildflowers stands out clearly? Such criticisms, even when delivered with a touch of disdain, never offend me. The reasoning is sound, the intention commendable, to establish the truth, to distinguish the real from the unreal. I try to experience it their way, the movement of a chipmunk behind the sunlit lattice, the dim fingers conjured from the dark leaves. It isn't impossible. I exercise my full powers of imagination. I take their side against me. There is nothing there, behind the lattice. It's all an illusion. Excellent! I defeat myself. I abolish myself. I rejoice in such exercise. You. You who have no phantoms in your town, you who mock or scorn our reports, are you not deluding yourselves? For say you are driving out to the mall some pleasant afternoon. All of a sudden, it's always sudden, you remember your dead father sitting in the living room in the house of your childhood. He's reading a newspaper in the armchair next to the lamp table. You can see his frown of concentration, the fold of the paper, the moccasin slipper half hanging from his foot. The steering wheel is warm in the sun. Tomorrow you're going to dinner at a friend's house. You should take a bottle of wine. You see your friend laughing at the table, his wife lifting something from the stove. The shadows of telephone wires lie in long curves on the street. Your mother lies in the nursing home, her eyes always closed. Her photograph on your bookcase, a young woman smiling under a tree. You are lying in bed with a cold, and she is reading to you from a book you know by heart. Now she herself is a child, and you read to her while she lies there. Your sister will be coming up for a visit in 2 weeks. Your daughter playing in the backyard, your wife at the window. Phantoms of memory, phantoms of desire. You pass through a world so thick with phantoms that there's barely enough room for anything else. The sun shines on a hydrant, casting a long shadow. Explanation number 6. One explanation says that we ourselves are phantoms. Arguments drawn from cognitive science claim that our bodies are nothing but artificial constructs of our brains. We are the dream creations of electrically charged neurons. The world itself is a great seeming. One virtue of this explanation is that it accounts for the behavior of our phantoms. They turn from us because they cannot bear to witness our self-delusion. Forgetfulness. There are times when we forget our phantoms. On summer afternoons, the telephone wires glow in the sun like fire. Shadows of tree branches lie against our white shingles. Children shout in the street. The air is warm, the grass is green, we will never die. Then an uneasiness comes in the blue air. Between shouts we hear a silence. It's as though something is about to happen, which we ought to know if only we could remember. How things are. For most of us, the phantoms are simply there. We don't think about them continually. At times we forget them entirely, but when we encounter them we feel that something momentous has taken place before we drift back into forgetfulness. Someone once said that our phantoms are like thoughts of death. They're always there, but appear only now and then. It's difficult to know exactly what we feel about our phantoms, but I think it's fair to say that in the moment we see them, before we're seized by a familiar emotion like fear or anger or curiosity, we are struck by a sense of strangeness, as if we suddenly entered a room which we had never seen before, a room that nevertheless feels familiar. Then the world shifts back into place and we continue on our way. For though we have our phantoms, our town is like your town. Sun shines on the house fronts. We wake in the night with troubled hearts. Cars back out of driveways and turn up the street. It's true that a question runs through our town because of the phantoms, but we don't believe we're the only ones who live with unanswered questions. Most of us would say we're no different from anyone else. When you come to think about us from time to time, you'll see we really are just like you. And that story was Phantoms by Stephen Milhauser from The Best American Short Stories from the year 2011, edited by Geraldine Brooks. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. The Hitman by T. Corrigessen Boyle. Early Years. The hitman's early years are complicated by the black bag that he wears over his head. Teachers correct his pronunciation, the coach criticizes his attitude, the principal dresses him down for branding preschoolers with a lit cigarette. He's a poor student. At lunch he sits alone, feeding bell peppers and salami into the dark slot of his mouth. In the hallways, wiry young athletes snatch at the black hood and slap the back of his head. When he's 13, he's approached by the captain of the football team, who pins him down and attempts to remove the hood. The hitman wastes him. 5 years, says the judge. Back on the street. The hitman is back on the street in 2 months. First date. The girl's name is Cynthia. The hitman pulls up in front of her apartment in his father's hearse. The hitman's father, whom he loathes and abominates, is a mortician. At breakfast, the hitman's father had slapped the cornflakes from his son's bowl. The son threatened to waste his father. He did not, restrained no doubt by considerations of filial loyalty and the deep-seated taboos against patricide that permeate the universal unconscious. Cynthia's father has silver sideburns and plays tennis. He responds to the hitman's knock, expresses surprise at the hitman's appearance. The hitman takes Cynthia by the elbow, presses a 20 into her father's palm, and disappears into the night. Father's death. At breakfast, the hitman slaps the cornflakes from his father's bowl. then wastes him. Mother's death. The hitman is in his early 20s. He shoots pool, lifts weights, and drinks milk from the carton. His mother is in the hospital dying of cancer or heart disease. The priest wears black. So does the hitman. First job. Porfirio Buñoz, a Cuban financier, invites the hitman to lunch. I hear you're looking for work, says Buñoz. That's right, says the hitman. Peas. The hitman does not like peas. They are too difficult to balance on the fork. Talk show. The hitman waits in the wings, the white slash of a cigarette scarring the midnight black of his head and upper torso. The makeup girl has done his mouth and eyes, brushed the nap of his hood. He has been briefed. The guest who precedes him is a pediatrician. A planetary glow washes the stage where the host and the pediatrician, separated by a potted palm, cross their legs and discuss the little disturbances of infants and toddlers. After the station break, the hitman finds himself squeezed into a director's chair, white lights in his eyes. The talk show host is a baby-faced man in his early 40s. He smiles like God and all his angels. Well, he says, so you're a hitman. Tell me, I've always wanted to know, what does it feel like to hit someone? Death of Mateo Maria Buñoz. The body of Mateo Maria Buñoz, the cousin and business associate of a prominent financier, is discovered down by the docks on a hot summer morning. Mist rises from the water like steam. There's the smell of fish. A large black bird perches on the dead man's forehead. Marriage. Cynthia and the hitman stand at the altar side by side. She is wearing a white satin gown and lace veil. The hitman has rented a tuxedo, extra large, and a silk-lined black velvet hood. Till death do you part, says the priest. Moods. The hitman is moody, unpredictable. Once, in a luncheonette, the waitress brought him the meatloaf special but forgot to eliminate the peas. There was a spot of gravy on the hitman's hood about where his chin should be. He looked up at the waitress, his eyes like pins behind the triangular slots, and wasted her. Another time he went to the track with $25, came back with $1,800. He stopped at a cigar shop. As he stepped out of the shop, a wino tugged at his sleeve and solicited a quarter. The hitman reached into his pocket, extracted the $1,800, and handed it to the wino, then wasted him. First child. A boy. The hitman is delighted. He leans over the edge of the playpen and molds the tiny fingers around the grip of a nickel-plated derringer. The gun is loaded with blanks. The hitman wants the boy to get used to the noise. By the time he's 4, the boy has mastered the rudiments of Taekwondo, can stick a knife in the wall from a distance of 10 feet, and shoot a moving target with either hand. The hitman rests his broad palm on the boy's head. You're going to make the big leagues, Tiger, he says. Work. He flies to Cincinnati, to L.A., to Boston, to London. The stewardesses get to know him. Half an acre and a garage. The hitman is raking leaves, amassing great brittle piles of them. He's wearing a black T-shirt cut off at the shoulders and a cotton work hood, also black. Cynthia's edging the flower bed, his son playing in the grass. The hitman waves to his neighbors as they drive by. The neighbors wave back. When he has scoured the lawn to his satisfaction, the hitman draws the small leaf hummocks together in a single mound the size of a pickup truck. Then he bends to ignite it with his lighter. Immediately, flames leap back from the leaves, cut channels through the pile, engulf it in a ball of fire. The hitman stands back, hands folded beneath the great meaty biceps. At his side is the three-headed dog. He bends to pat each of the heads, smoke and sparks raging against the sky. Stalking the streets of the city. He is stalking the streets of the city, collar up, brim down. It is late at night. He stalks past department stores, small businesses, parks, gas stations. Past apartments, picket fences, picture windows. Dogs growl in the shadows, then slink away. He could hit any of us. Retirement. A group of businessman types, 60-ish, 70-ish, portly, diamond rings, cigars, liver spots, throws him a party. Porfirio Buñoz, now in his 80s, makes a speech and presents the hitman with a gilded scythe. The hitman thanks him, then retires to the lake, where he can be seen in his speedboat, skating out over the blue, hood rippling in the breeze. Death. He is stricken, shrunken, half his former self. He lies propped against the pillows at Mercy Hospital, a bank of gentians drooping around the bed. Tubes run into the hood at the nostril openings. His eyes are clouded and red, sunk deep behind the triangular slots. The priest wears black. So does the hitman. On the other side of town, the hitman's son is standing before a mirror of a shop that specializes in hitman attire, trying on his first hood. And that story was Hitman by T. Corrigessen Boyle from Sudden Fiction, American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44, from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. Rewinding an Overdose on a Projector by Sean Shearer. Blacker, black, the foam drools back up on his chin, over his lips and behind his teeth. The boy on the floor floats onto the bed. Gravity returns. His hands twitch. The heart wakes like a handcar pumping faster and faster on its greased tracks. Eyes flick open. Blood threads through the needle, draws into a tube. The syringe handle lifts his thumb. The hole in his vein where he left us seals. The boy injects a liquid onto the cotton that drowns inside a spoon. He unties the leather belt around his arm, pushes the sleeve to his wrist. The wet cotton lifts, fluffs into a dry white ball. The flame beneath the spoon shrinks to a spark, is sucked inside the chamber where it grows cold, then colder. The heroin bubbles to powder. The water pours into a plastic bottle. The powder rains into a vial where it sleeps like an only child. All the contents on the bed spill into a bag. The boy stands, feeds his belt through the loops. This is where I snip the film and burn it. What remains are the few hundred frames reeling, the boy unlocking a bedroom door, a black jacket rising from the floor, each sleeve taking an arm like a mother and father. And that was Rewinding an Overdose on a Projector by Sean Shearer, from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44, from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.